It's Thursday, March 28, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. In the second day of oral arguments on the issue of same-sex marriage before the United States Supreme Court, day two seemed to be quite a bit different than day one. Day one, that is Tuesday of this week, featured oral arguments on the case challenging Proposition 8, California's constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. But day two, that is yesterday, had to do with the Defense of Marriage Act and the charge that that act, enacted in 1996, violates the Constitution by discriminating amongst married couples. Now, the oral arguments on Tuesday revealed a court that gave very few signals about how it would eventually rule on the question of Proposition 8. There were signals given by various justices, but the most important issue was that the justices seemed to be somewhat peeved that the case had come before them at all. On the Defense of Marriage Act, the court seemed to have a different attitude. But those who observed the oral arguments yesterday seemed to be almost unanimous in believing that at least five justices, that is a majority of the nine justices, indicated a willingness to overturn the Defense of Marriage Act. For instance, Justice Anthony Kennedy, who has been considered for a long time to be the most likely swing vote on the issue, that is the decisive fifth vote, as Adam Liptak and Peter Baker, the New York Times report, he returned again and again to the theme that deciding who is married is a matter for the states. The federal government, he said, should respect, quote, the historic commitment of marriage and the rights of children to the states, end quote. Those who have been watching these cases come before the United States Supreme Court had been aware for a long time that it is the Defense of Marriage Act that is more at danger of being overturned even than California's Proposition 8. And that's because this is a federal act, and it is because it is one that is squarely within this court's jurisdiction. Nevertheless, even as some issues were heard in a preliminary manner yesterday, there was a challenge to the fact that this case had come before the court. However, that argument did not seem to gain much traction. What we're looking at here in terms of the oral arguments yesterday is also revealing on a score of other issues. Justice Kennedy, once again, referring to the Defense of Marriage Act, said, quote, "You are at real risk with running in conflict with what has always been the essence of state power," which he went on to explain was to regulate marriage as well as the issues of divorce and custody. This is a federalism argument that has appealed to many justices on other issues as well. It is an important part of our American jurisprudence, and it does underline something that has certainly been true from the very beginning of our nation's experiment, and that is that it has been up to the states primarily to define marriage. But we do need to recognize that there is no way to slice that so clearly. For instance, the federal government, by its own programs, rules, and regulations, must have a definition of marriage. It simply cannot escape it. After all, it is the federal government that administers programs such as the Social Security program. The military, after all, belongs also to the federal government. Thus, it is the federal government that must, in a score of issues, indeed, some estimate over 1,200 different issues, it must define marriage. So even as Justice Kennedy indicated that perhaps his way of resolving this issue is simply to say that marriage is entirely a matter for the states, the very fact that the federal government will continue to define marriage in some meaningful way betrays the fact that it is not so easy an escape as he might insist. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the associate justice, said, quote, "There are two kinds of marriage, full marriage and the skim milk marriage," end quote. She was insinuating that the federal government has put the states in a position where some states have their definition of marriage, that is, the states that have legalized same-sex marriage, put at a lower state than those that do not. It's a very interesting argument, one that is certain to have created sound bites in terms of the oral arguments. Justice Elena Kagan said that as she was viewing the Defense of Marriage Act, she found what she suggested to be an animus against homosexuals, against the argument that was made by Paul Clement, arguing in defense of the Marriage Act that it was an effort by Congress to come up with a uniform definition of marriage. She asked this question: do we really think Congress was doing this for uniformity reasons, or do we think the Congress's judgment was infected by dislike, by animus, by fear, end quote. She also read a quote from a House record at the time the law was passed suggesting that lawmakers wanted to show, quote, moral disapproval of homosexuality, end quote. We're going to be looking at that issue very closely tomorrow, because one of the things that this particular set of oral arguments has demonstrated is that what is now considered to be absolutely out of bounds, not only before the court, but before the court of public opinion, is any suggestion that homosexuality and homosexual behavior is in any way immoral. We'll return to that tomorrow. Meanwhile, perhaps in one of the sharpest exchanges before the court yesterday, the Chief Justice John G. Roberts, actually criticized not the attorney before him, nor Congress, but President Obama. He, along with several of the other conservative justices, expressed irritation that the case had come before them, and they blamed the President of the United States and his stance, quote, to enforce the law but not to defend it, end quote, suggesting that that was internally and irresponsibly contradictory. The Chief Justice said, quote, I don't see why he doesn't have the courage of his convictions. And he meant not enforce the law if he thinks it's unconstitutional. Meanwhile, in terms of the court of public opinion, editorials have been appearing in virtually every newspaper across the land, and columnists and talking heads in the commentariat have been making their positions known as well. Maureen Dowd, feminist, writing her column for the New York Times, suggests that the court, at least on the question of Proposition 8, is in danger of, in her words, courting cowardice. She wrote this. As the arguments unfurled in Tuesday's case on same-sex marriage, the Supreme Court justices sounded more and more cranky. Things are moving too fast for them. How could the nine cloistered behind velvety rose curtains, marble pillars, and archaic customs possibly assess the potential effects of gay marriage? They're not psychics, after all. End quote. She's making fun here, but as she does so, she actually unintentionally undermines her own argument. The very purpose of having a court like this is that it would be dispassionate. It's not supposed to be a court of sociologists. It's not supposed to be the court of public opinion. It's supposed to be the court that evaluates cases on the basis of the Constitution of the United States, on the basis of a text that appears to be missing from her concern here, as she is instead leaning into sociological analysis. The editorial that appeared in yesterday's edition of the Financial Times of London was actually even more blunt. This warns the United States Supreme Court that it could be left behind by history if it doesn't get with the program and find a full constitutional right of same-sex couples to marry. The editorial in the Financial Times writes, moreover, the tide of opinion is unusually strong. Just a decade ago, fewer than one-third of the U.S. public supported same-sex marriage. That share has risen to well over half. The larger backlash would probably be in the other direction were the Supreme Court to uphold discriminatory laws. End quote. But the final paragraph of this editorial is even more forceful. They write, there is no reasonable justification for the federal government to deny recognition of marriages already sanctioned by state law. Gay marriage is currently recognized in 9 U.S. states, and many more are considering doing so. The court should strike the law down. Then this final sentence, history is running in favor of equal rights for gays. It's time for the Supreme Court to move with it. End quote. Again, this is not a constitutional argument. This is not a legal argument. This is by no means a textual argument. It's an argument from sociology. It's a political argument. And yes, we must remind Maureen Dowd, the Supreme Court is behind those curtains and standing amidst those pillars precisely because it is not supposed to be worried about the tide of history, but rather the text of the Constitution. We'll be watching the debate that follows the oral arguments this week on the issue of same-sex marriage, and there will be much to see and no doubt much to discuss as well. Next, on a different issue that may even shortly also appear before the United States Supreme Court, North Dakota has now passed a law that virtually outlaws abortion in that state. A couple of things that will surprise many Americans are these. First of all, even as the United States still has Roe v. Wade as the standing law of the land, state legislatures have been doing their very best to chip away and indeed now directly to confront the logic and the text of Roe v. Wade. That means that the governor of North Dakota, Jack Dalrymple, knew exactly what he was doing when he signed this bill into law. He was setting up a direct collision with Roe v. Wade. But the second thing we need to recognize is that there are laws against abortion, laws that would ban virtually all abortions on the books in several states right now. However, these laws by the legislatures of those states have been put in abeyance until such time as Roe v. Wade is nullified or removed. Now, when you look at the action taken yesterday by Governor Dalrymple in North Dakota, we again need to recognize that he knew exactly what he was doing in signing these three laws. He intends directly to challenge Roe v. Wade. The most important of those laws makes abortions illegal once a fetal heartbeat is detectable. That can be as early as 6 weeks. Again, a direct collision with Roe v. Wade. The governor said this, quote, although the likelihood of this measure surviving a court challenge remains in question, this bill is nevertheless a legitimate attempt by a state legislature to discover the boundaries of Roe v. Wade. He went on to say that the Supreme Court, quote, has never considered the precise restriction that was adopted by North Dakota in its considerations of abortion in cases past. Now, what we're looking at here also divides at least many in the pro-life movement, some who believe that the best way to address the issue of abortion is to chip away at the margins of Roe. That has been the general strategy undertaken by the pro-life movement for the last 20 years. But more recently, states and pro-life advocates who have become very frustrated with a lack of progress have decided to go and to address themselves to constitutional challenges directly addressed at Roe. Now, the upshot of all of this is that even as the Supreme Court is deciding whether it can put to an end the national debate over same-sex marriage, it had better recognize that its attempt back in 1973 to put the issue of abortion to rest was not only not successful, it was cataclysmically unsuccessful. Also, if we're going to argue about the tide of history, we need to recognize that increasing percentages of Americans indicate that they are pro-life. Again, that's not a textual argument, it's a sociological argument. But it does show the contradiction before the United States Supreme Court if it's going to decide that the direction of polls is to indicate the direction of its jurisprudence. Meanwhile, on a very different issue, this is the issue of pornography, and specifically female literary pornography. Here's a number for you, 70 million. That's how many copies of the 50 Shades trilogy has been sold by Random House in print, hardback, paperback, and electronic editions, also in editions translated into other countries. It is now the best-selling title ever published by Random House, and it has spawned an entire new industry of female literary pornography. The books are undoubtedly pornographic. The headline in the Wall Street Journal says, "Oh my, that dirty book has sold 70 million copies." As Jeffrey Trachtenberg of the Wall Street Journal reports, those sales made the books Random House's fastest-selling series ever. Indeed, the trilogy is one of the fastest-selling book series for any publisher ever, hitting the 20 million sales mark in the United States after just 4 months on the market. In other words, marketers are all over this. Now all kinds of series trying to parrot the success of 50 Shades are out. All kinds of imitation series, all kinds of successor series, and all of them share one thing in common. The discovery by the American publishing market, and now the publishing market largely worldwide, that there is a market for female pornography. It isn't visual, it is literary, but it is graphic in terms of its sexual depictions, and also in terms of the fact that it is, as is so often the case with visual pornography, absolutely based on sex outside of marriage. And furthermore, other things that would not be politely mentioned in terms of this analysis. What we're looking at here is the fact that it is hardly a sign of progress for our civilization. The pornography that has been such a struggle for so many men is now increasingly becoming a struggle for so many women. Or maybe not a struggle at all. The celebration of the sales figures in this news report is what is perhaps most striking. Yes, it's referred to as a dirty book, but you'll notice that those who are about the book publishing business think that this is now unalloyed good news. There's good news for those who are trying to sell such things and understanding that there is a market for female pornography that goes beyond what any publisher knew just a year ago. That tells us, as Christians, a great deal about human nature that we already know from Scripture. In other words, when it comes to selling sin, we're the ones who are supposed to know up front there is already a market for it. Finally, a news report that has to do with something that would be of immediate value to parents, but also in terms of the Christian worldview, affirms something that the authors of the research report don't even seem to understand. Here's the headline from USA Today. Teens get an extra helping of good at each family dinner. End quote. The story is by Sharon Jason. And it has to do with a report published just last week in the academic journal known as the Journal of Adolescent Health. Now, for some time, it has been documented that when children, and teenagers specifically, have dinners, sit-down dinners at home with their family, this turns out to all good kinds of effects. Or at least, we should say, that correlated with having a sit-down dinner with family are good effects such as better grades, higher self-esteem, far fewer activities in terms of dangerous things such as crime and juvenile delinquency, far higher rates of school attendance, and also the fact that children who have, and adolescents in particular, who have meals with their family, sit-down meals, are far less likely to smoke, to drink, or to use drugs, or to have early sex. So what we're talking about here is research that we already knew about that says this is good for teenagers. But here's the new research, published just last week in the Journal of Adolescent Health. It turns out that it is such a helpful thing for teenagers, even more so than children, by the way, a more decisive change for the good for teenagers. The more meals a week a teenager has with his family or her family sitting at the table, the greater the effect. In other words, it doesn't even plateau out. It's not even the case that after 3 or 4 of these meals a week, there's no effect after that. There is an effect. Having 7, 8, 9, 10 meals a week, sitting down with a family, turns out, leads to even better grades, even less alcohol use, even less involvement in dangerous activities. That's good news. Now, according to this report, this is all basically about pediatric medicine and adolescent sociology. But as Christians, we know there's something more to it than that. We know that just as marriage is a divine creation, not just a human sociological experiment, we know also that the nuclear family, or at least what we would call the natural family, the family with mom and dad and siblings sitting down at the table, the celebration of the domestic arrangement, of the relationship of love and acceptance, of love and security, of love and discipline that is represented by the family, and the act of sitting down together that reminds each other, sitting across the table from one another, that we are family, that we belong to each other, that engages in conversation where adolescents who otherwise might have very little to say to one another or to another family member sit at a dinner table where they're expected actually not only to hear but also to talk. It turns out that this has a massively positive effect. But Christians should have known that all along. We don't need sociology to tell us that the institutions that God has given us will lead to maximum human flourishing. Where marriage and family are most honored, where the goods of marriage and family are most graciously and thankfully received, good things will happen to every member of the family. And, as families are strengthened, to the larger society as well. Oh, by the way, one footnote in this study, you probably thought about this already. This only works if the social media is left off the table. By the way, not only for teenagers, but also for their parents. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow, Good Friday, for The Briefing.